From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Venezuela's been on a rough ride for a while now. Lately, it's a lot rougher. Streets full of protest, long lines for food. A president opponents say is reaching for a Cuba-style one-man rule, who Washington now calls a dictator. This hour on Point, Venezuela in big trouble. Plus, we'll look at conflicting Republican impulses on Obamacare now, to push it to fail or to fix it. You can join us on air or online with this conversation, as always, on First Venezuela. Where does the crumbling, the turmoil, end? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Two leading opposition figures in Venezuela arrested over the weekend, middle of the night, seized right from their homes. One, Antonio Ledezma, seized from his home in an overnight raid. The government said he had violated the terms of his house arrest by making political statements to reporters. Ledezma's eldest daughter took this video of the scene. Being bundled into a car, off to who knows where. She's saying, what's happening? They're taking Ledezma. They're taking Ledezma. This is a dictatorship. Dictatorship. The sound of turmoil out of Venezuela. On Monday, at a White House press briefing, National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster read a statement by President Donald Trump condemning Venezuela's refusal to adhere to democratic principles, including releasing political prisoners and holding free and fair elections.
The regime has refused to heed this call, and its recent actions, culminating in yesterday's outrageous seizure of absolute power through the sham election of the National Constituent Assembly, represent a very serious blow to democracy in our hemisphere. Maduro is not just a bad leader, he is now a dictator.
Joining me now from Caracas in Venezuela is Anatoly Kermanayev, Venezuela correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. He's been following the latest out of the country and reporting on President Nicolas Maduro's power grab. Anatoly, welcome back to On Point. What's the latest step in what Washington is now calling a move toward dictatorship?
Hi, Tom. Well, a very momentous week here in Venezuela, and then today is actually quite a crucial day as well. In just a few hours from now, President Maduro is going to inaugurate this new assembly here in Caracas, 550-member body, which will have absolute powers to do absolutely anything at once: rewrite the constitution, redraw all state institutions, hire and fire anyone at once. It will be more powerful even than the president himself. And this is all happening amid grown evidence of fraud in the election on Sunday that elected this assembly just a few hours ago. The company that owns the voting machine, Smartmatic, came out and said that there's a discrepancy of at least 1 million votes between what the government has reported and what they're seeing on their machine data. And Reuters was able to obtain documents from the electoral authorities here in Venezuela that said that only 3.7 million people voted in the election. This is against 8 million that the government claims. So very becoming increasingly difficult for Maduro to sustain that he represents a majority and the majority of the country wants to go ahead with this momentous change.
Anatoly, explain why this weekend's vote was so important. I mean, Maduro has been knocking away elements of Venezuelan democracy for years, packing the courts with loyalists to him and blocking opposition lawmakers from taking their seats there, overturning laws that he opposed, suspending elections, tried unsuccessfully to dissolve the sitting legislature, which is dominated by the opposition, to dissolve it altogether. On Sunday, Venezuelans were given this, vote for it. There was no way to vote against it. I get no option to turn down the plan to bring in a constituent assembly, which is different than our Congress or a proper parliament. This is a kind of a ruling junta.
A pretty large ruling junta, Tom, is a pretty good way to describe it. So what happened here on Sunday and why it was crucial is that this is a day when Venezuela stopped being a democracy. It's as simple as that. This government has been in power for 18 years and has gradually been nibbling away at these democratic processes that you described. But when the push came to shove and the election came, the electoral authorities could always be trusted to count the votes. You know, they would always come out and say how many people voted, and it was always a credible and true number that no one serious has ever denied. So the playing field was being tilted increasingly towards the government, but the elections themselves were fair. On Sunday, they simply made up a number. There's no other way to describe it. You know, but all the evidence points to it, even, as I said, including evidence from Venezuelan government itself. So he crossed that red line from a troubled democracy into dictatorship.
All right. This started out with Hugo Chavez. Maduro came in after him. Chavez seemed to have popular support. At this point, what is it possible to read how Venezuelans feel about the president? They voted opposition into the parliament. Does that mean the country is majority against the man who's now taking something like complete absolute power?
Yeah, it's very clear by now that the government is a minority. Latest polls show Maduro with approval ratings of about 17%. This is still pretty high for Latin American standards, Tom. You know, this is higher than, for example, Mexico, Brazil, you know, the big countries in the region. But, you know, keep in mind that in this country of polarization, this also means that more than 80% of the people, 4 in 5 Venezuelans, absolutely despise this government and want to get rid of it at any cost. That's what makes it so difficult and so dangerous. So Maduro is trying to withdraw the state. He's trying to completely redesign the Venezuelan Republic with support of 1 in 5 Venezuelans, which, of course, is extremely dangerous, and we can expect more violence. He still has the support of the armed forces because of economic benefits they have. He controls all state institutions and is about to get rid of the few remaining ones that still oppose him. But he is training on very thin ice, which could result in a tragedy.
Opponents are describing this as turning into a Cuba-style one-man rule, one-party rule. Is that a fair comparison, Anatoly?
Yeah, I must say the way things are going, I think we'll be pretty lucky if this becomes Cuba. You know, keep in mind that for all Cuba's problems, it's a very safe country. And it's a country where people, you know, do struggle to survive, but they have the basics to get by. Venezuela is a country with second highest homicide rate in the world. It's a country with massive growing malnutrition, where we see infants dying in hospitals for lack of food. We see people dying for lack of basic medicines. And this is worse than Cuba, you know, and on many levels. And it's only going to get worse as the economy continues to contract and as the government becomes more autocratic. And that's the real concern here.
Of course, Venezuela had big problems of inequality before all of this began, going on 2 decades ago now. What about the United States' reaction here? There are sanctions against Maduro. There are reportedly further sanctions contemplated here. Does the U.S., does the rest of the region or the world have leverage on Mr. Maduro?
Well, the world is has shown an unprecedented unity in the last week on Venezuela's situation. About 12 countries around the world, from Switzerland, Argentina, to the U.S., said they will not recognize these elections. President Trump has rolled out sanctions against Maduro. By now, pretty much Maduro's entire inner circle is under sanction for charges ranging from drug trafficking to human rights abuses to corruption. But it hasn't gone beyond personal sanctions. President Trump has threatened swift, strong economic reaction to this fraudulent vote. There's a lot of talk of sanctions against Venezuela's crucial oil industry. But so far, the Trump administration has not gone that route because of the cost that is involved to the U.S. domestic gasoline prices, to the jobs in U.S. Refining sector. We haven't seen Trump prepared to pay the political cost of making, you know, putting real pressure on Venezuela. And it remains to be seen whether he'll be prepared to do that. You know, the biggest hope so far is some sort of unified, strong response from Latin America, which will sort of, you know, prevent Maduro from saying this is all one big U.S. orchestrated conspiracy.
Is there any news on what happened to these two leaders who were dragged away in the middle of the night, Leopoldo López and U.S. educated Antonio Ledezma? Do we know their whereabouts? These are very prominent opposition figures.
Absolutely, Tom. Leopoldo López is the most popular politician in the country, according to polls. And Antonio Ledezma, he's the elected mayor of the capital, Caracas. They are both back in military jail. According to their lawyers, they have spent, Leopoldo López has spent 3 years there already. Quite a dramatic move from Maduro following these elections. But you know, what he's trying to do here, Tom, are two things. First, given that the election was clearly a fraud, and everyone here knows that, Maduro has to show to his core supporters, don't worry, I can do anything I want. Stick with me because I can ensure that this goes through despite all these problems. And he's also trying to create, to raise his bargaining power in any eventual negotiations with the United States, with the opposition, with the international community, to have basically chips to trade in if he has to sit down and come out with some sort of solution to it.
And what about the elected parliament, which is dominated by opposition to Maduro? Will it be dissolved now, just ignored? What happens?
That's a big question, Tom. Today's inauguration of this new body, this new constituent assembly, is taking place elsewhere in Caracas, in some sports arena on the outskirts of Caracas. It's not going to be inaugurated in the Congress itself, which is what the opposition has feared. They say the new body wants to dissolve them completely. They want to take over all their functions. So far, the signs point that Maduro wants to keep two parallel bodies going simultaneously, which, you know, again, gives him some sort of negotiating room. If talks, formal talks, to begin, he can say, well, I haven't actually done anything to this assembly. He just sits there with some sort of a trigger, basically, to the opposition head, prepared to dissolve them at a minute's notice. But, of course, keep in mind, Tom, that the real Congress, the elected Congress, the opposition control Congress, has no real power. The government has stripped it of all its functions. It's basically a talking body, you know, where they get together, where they pass some laws that get vetoed or denied. And that's it. But it's still a very important symbol in Venezuela to have an opposition-controlled institution.
The real elected Congress stripped of all powers, and Venezuela on a tough, rough path right now. Anatoly Kamenayev, Venezuela correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for joining us from Caracas, Anatoly.
Great.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the political turmoil in a Venezuela sliding toward authoritarian, maybe Cuba-style rule. You just heard our Wall Street Journal reporter saying they'd be lucky to be Cuba-style, given that economically, things are relatively well off in Cuba. Venezuela, a real mess lately, and big steps just in the last few days that have people, has Washington, the Trump administration, saying dictatorship now in Venezuela under President Maduro. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you see? Do we see a one-man, one-party rule taking over in Venezuela? And what has taken things there from bad to worse? Did the moneyed classes in Venezuela blow it years ago, paying too little attention to the rest of the country? And how should the United States respond to Maduro and his moves now? Have you, your family, been in Venezuela recently? What have you seen? Very dramatic developments, and we've had months of fighting in the streets there. 100-plus dead. BBC reporting last month about young Venezuelan protesters calling themselves the resistance. Here's one describing why he chooses to fight against the government. A young man, face covered, given an English voiceover so as to conceal his identity.
I believe I prefer to die than to live in this way, governed by the Constitutional Assembly and all that. The way I see it, I will never be able to achieve my potential as a person here because the government is not.
Drowned out there with all the tear gas and gunfire after Sunday's vote in Venezuela, which the company that runs the machines there now says that those machines were tampered with. The turnout was not what the government required or described it to be. On Monday, we had U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin opening the White House press briefing announcing sanctions on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro.
By sanctioning Maduro, the United States makes clear our opposition to the policies of his regime and the support for the people of Venezuela, who strive to return their country to a full and prosperous democracy. As the country's head of state, Maduro is directly responsible for Venezuela's descent and for the destruction of democracy.
He's happy to push back President Maduro from Venezuela against what he calls the imperialist United States. On Monday evening, Republican Florida Senator Marco Rubio delivered a televised address to the Venezuelan people on Global Vision, 24-hour news network broadcast throughout Venezuela, a lot of Latin America. Here was Marco Rubio, U.S. Senator.
La raíz de todas estas tragedias no es una batalla política.
And he's saying the root of all these tragedies isn't a political battle between left and right. There are many nations in our hemisphere around the world that have found space to accommodate different points of view in their political systems. The root and cause of these tragedies, says Senator Rubio, is tyranny. A tyranny that jails and kills those who are seen as a menace to power, the power of President Maduro. So you get a sense of just how tense this has become. Got a couple of great guests here in a moment. Just a couple of calls here first. Leo in Boston. Leo, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Yes, hello. Thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a dual citizen. I'm American and Venezuelan. I have been all my life against all interventions of the U.S. in different countries because they result in a mess, maybe with the exceptions of Second World War. But I have to tell you, I thought I would never say this in my lifetime. I think the United States has to intervene with military. Why? Because the difference with the other countries in Venezuela, there is a very defined opposition. Not only the opposition, they are in power of Congress. So they will be ready to do new elections and take control. But we have all the military against the people, against the 80% of the Venezuelan people. I'm telling you, Tom, if the Trump administration doesn't do anything in Venezuela, Putin will. And this is something that maybe resonates with Republicans. They don't want to have a Ukraine in South America. The violence against the people has been very, I can't think what Maduro can do, anything else.
But Leo, American intervention in Latin America, military intervention, you know the history of that. It's not pretty.
I know it's not, but this is, if one country is the right country to intervene, is to help, and at the right moment is Venezuela. Otherwise, we're going to see Venezuela deepen into dictatorship, and it's going to be too late in 20 years to try to go there when there's no opposition to take control.
Leo, I really appreciate your call. I gotta take it right there. Let me hold that and get one more call, then we'll go to our guests who are very deeply steeped in all this. Luke in Madison, Wisconsin. Leo, thank you. Luke, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I just wanted to call in and kind of give a different, take on what's been happening. The majority of the press in the U.S. has been trying to portray this as being, Maduro is going further towards authoritarianism. That the
trying to portray. You see what's happened there, Luke? Doesn't it look like? I mean, he just end run the elected Congress to put in this sort of handpicked through a bogus vote. Yeah. That looks like more than just an assertion.
I don't think it's a stretch to say that the U.S. has used, CIA intelligence. They've done it before. They've done it with, putting in place Pinochet in Chile, trying to change things around there, trying to give him the position that he needs to be able to commit a coup against Salvador Allende. It's happened, every single country that's ever tried to call itself socialist or communist. The U.S. has gotten itself involved militarily or with its intelligence. So I think that, whatever kinds of, information is being portrayed, while there's a lot of valid information, I do believe that Maduro's government is making the wrong moves, is moving away from, moving towards a bureaucracy. It's also without this kind of context of what's going on and why he might be moving towards this bureaucracy. They're in a situation, an economic situation where, due to the fall in oil prices, they've been unable to sustain the kind of social programs that were put in place by Hugo Chavez, which were, necessary in order to pull the country out of the kind of poverty he was sitting in, with almost 70% of the population in poverty.
Yeah, that's
5% in extreme poverty.
Yeah.
And he changed, the situation around with these social programs. All of a sudden, oil prices drop. They can't afford it. The ruling class in Venezuela has been demanding, greater margins of profit on the food that they want to sell. So instead of selling it for a lower price, they've been stockpiling and creating a false scarcity.
Luke, let me take it right there. I don't know about false scarcity, but there's no question there was deep inequality here. Hugo Chavez gained big popular support, it seemed, from my chair in response to that. But where we are now looks pretty darn difficult. I appreciate your call from Madison, Wisconsin. I want to welcome into the conversation now from Atlanta, Jennifer McCoy, professor of Latin American politics at Georgia State University. She was a mediator in Venezuela in 2002 after a failed coup against then-President Hugo Chavez, author of International Mediation in Venezuela. Jennifer McCoy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And with us from Washington is Moises Rendon. He's Associate Director, Associate Fellow for the Americas Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is Venezuelan. Moises Rendon, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation, Tom.
Moises, can we first go to our Madison caller says, look, you had super deep inequality in Venezuela, tons of poverty. Hugo Chavez came in on the back of that, tried to do something about it. Yes, it had a socialist face to it. That got a lot of people upset outside Venezuela, and they've toyed with Venezuela. Do you see something that's falling here or flailing because of outside intervention or because Venezuelans don't want what they've been offered?
Yes, no, thank you. Venezuela is, in fact, going through the darkest days and week of its entire history. This new Constituent Assembly pretends to impose a new system, a new authoritarian system legally. They are pretending to not only change laws and codes, but also dismantle institutions. They want also to change property rights. They want to change the right to protest on the streets. That all is on the table, and it's just a matter of days and weeks that this new illegitimate assembly start acting. So what we have seen in Venezuela is a deterioration of what is being a totalitarian regime throughout all these last 15 years. It's not a new situation. It's only an increasing and getting out of control a scenario in Venezuela.
Jennifer, there seemed to be wide popular support in Hugo Chavez's day for a time for many of his measures. They may not have been popular with those who had done well before him, but they seemed popular with the poor and maybe the lower middle class. What about now?
Well, you're exactly right. He did have a lot of support, particularly from people who had felt like they had been invisible in the past or not represented by prior governments and not benefiting from the oil riches of the country. And he did distribute a lot of oil wealth when oil prices were high. But now, as Anatoly reported, Maduro has only about 20% popular support, which is important to recognize. That's an important segment. But many people are extremely upset and frustrated and suffering from the severe shortages of medicine, healthcare, food, and an extremely high crime rate. So there's great, great frustration and disapproval of this government today.
What about our caller's assertion that this is due in part to governments abroad putting Venezuela in a tough spot, even quietly intervening? Or is it primarily because oil prices fell, and they certainly have fallen a lot?
No, I certainly would. Maduro tries to blame it on outsiders and a colluding private sector within Venezuela. But this is primarily the making of economic policy choices by this government and the previous Chavez government, hurt additionally by falling oil prices. But we have to recognize their own productive capacity to produce oil has fallen because of their own policy choices, along with controls of the currency. So we have a tremendous black market parallel rate, hyperinflation, and nationalization of many companies, so that there's simply very little production happening in the country.
Black market dollars going for 9,000 times the current official rate, from what I'm reading here. Strong criticism from Washington now. President Maduro, this was a speech on Sunday after the vote, which is now being called into big question, the legitimacy of this vote, the turnout that was reported, the makers of the machines that underwrote the vote, saying it's been falsified. We'll see about that. But this was Maduro lambasting President Donald Trump for calling the vote a sham. This is Venezuela's President Maduro addressing a crowd in Caracas.
Hoy un vocero del gobierno del emperador Donald Trump.
He says, today a spokesman for Emperor Donald Trump said that they would not recognize the result of Venezuela's constituent National Assembly election. And he goes on to say, why the hell should we care what Trump says? Herman is calling from Austin, Texas. Herman, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Tom. Nice. Thank you for getting my call.
Sure.
What I want to say is that this is a problem that has been going on, not from now. It's been going on since Chavez took power back in 98, and he's been assessed very well by the Cuban communists, because Cuba has been after Venezuela since Castro got on power, because of the oil and of the rich all the rich resources we have. And unfortunately, with Chavez, they got the country for free. They even tried to invade Venezuela back in the 60s, and they couldn't, because the democracy back then and the armed forces took them out. But now Chavez and now Maduro, which is just a puppet of Raul Castro, are the ones that are ruling the country, really. Raul Castro is Venezuelan's ruler, unfortunately. They talk about sovereignty, and they talk about getting the international intervention intervene to be an independent nation, and it happens all the contrary. Cuba, which is a poor country in a poor island in the Caribbean Sea, got one of the most richest country in Latin America, and it's a very, very sad situation.
Herman, let us pick it up right there. Moses Rendon, Moses, what about Cuba's role in in Venezuela's politics right now?
I will agree with Herman. Cuba has a very important presence, not only in politics, but in the civilian day-to-day life. They control a lot of register offices. They know who owns what in Venezuela. They are deeply involved on the military as well. And that's why I think the regime has gone so far now, because the Cubans have really been highly involved with Maduro and Chavez before, to consult with them how to deal with the situation on the ground.
What is that role? I've read that they provide security for Maduro. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. Personal security. The Cubans are in charge of Maduro's personal security.
What about intelligence operations, domestic?
That's true, too. Yeah, no, that is... Cuba is divided in two wings. No? The most radical wing, which is what Fidel Castro was leading before, and the Raul Castro, which is the more pragmatic kind of wing. In Venezuela, unfortunately, the Cuban presence is represented by the radical wing, by the Fidel Castro wing. And Cuba has a very strategic reason of having Venezuela on his side, because, like Herman was saying, Venezuela has the biggest oil reserves. Cuba cannot really sustain itself without the Venezuelan oil aid that it's receiving daily. So it's the new Soviet Union. It's the only resource that they can have available to sustain itself.
Jennifer, there in Atlanta, we had a caller suggesting that the U.S. should intervene here militarily. But he said if the U.S. doesn't, Vladimir Putin will. Is Russia active around Venezuela at all?
Certainly. Russia and China both are very important actors in terms of enabling the regime or the government of Maduro to survive financially in terms of investment, loans, and China being repaid in Venezuelan oil. So a lot of Venezuelan oil exports actually are going to China to repay prior loans and not earning new revenue. Russia has investments and right now has a stake, a 49% stake, in fact, in Citgo as collateral for its loans. Citgo is a company in the United States but owned by Venezuela. So they are important in terms of lenders of last resort, and we're going to see what happens when bond payments for PDVSA, the oil company, come due this November, and then next year sovereign debt, the national debt payments will come due, and whether Russia or China step up to continue to help the government pay those or not. If they don't, that will put increasing pressure and shrink the maneuvering space for this government.
I mean, if they don't make good on their sovereign debt, I've read you could see what their oil shipments begin to be impounded. Then they'd really be in trouble.
Exactly. They really depend on these oil revenues, most of which come from the United States. And I did want to point out that the U.S. has never cut off oil imports from Venezuela, despite bad relations with Chavez and with Maduro.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound there, a report from Sky News on Monday. Anti-government demonstrators in Caracas taking to the streets, National Guard motorcycles arriving, horns blaring. We've got turmoil in Venezuela, have had for some time now. Over the weekend, big new steps toward what many are describing as authoritarian government straight up. Jennifer McCoy is with us, professor in Latin American politics at Georgia State University. She was a mediator in Venezuela after a failed coup against Hugo Chavez. Back in 2002, she did that work. Moises Rendon is with us from the Center for Strategic Studies, Venezuelan, who pays a lot of attention to what's going on here. And we have just a few more minutes on this and lots of calls before we turn to the Affordable Care Act and its fate in Washington. Let me get a call from Austin, Texas. Jacinto, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I think that it's very critical right now for the U.S. to maximize the sanctions towards Venezuela. I think that the U.S. should stop buying oil from Venezuela. I think that will pretty much cut off the funding to the Maduro regime, and basically you're turning off the lights on them. And I think that will put quite a bit of pressure on them. I think also Cuba needs to be sanctioned for doing what they're doing in Venezuela as well.
Jacinto, let me pick up this oil leverage point. Moises, what about oil? If the U.S. stopped buying Venezuelan oil, would China just pick up the rest? Would Russia just pick up the rest? Would that really disrupt the cash flow to Maduro's government?
Yeah, no, thank you, Tom. That's part of the debate here in Washington. And I think the U.S. should expand sanctions not only on Maduro's immediate family, but also other key leaders in the regime. I think sanctioning the key leaders will just weaken the structure of the PSUV, the political party in Caracas, and that will trigger more, that will add more pressure on the regime. When it comes to oil, it's just a delicate and sensitive way to look at it. There is other ways that you can also sanction on the oil sector, not just cutting imports, but sanctioning, for example, refineries or sanction specific sectors in the oil where you can add that pressure that the international community should be doing on Venezuela in order to help.
But I didn't quite hear. Would others just pick up that oil, or would they be in trouble if the oil stopped being bought by the U.S.?
Yes. I mean, if they, yes, I think if the U.S. stop buying oil from Venezuela, that gap will be filled. Either Russia or China will be buying that oil or other players in the market. But that is a very important point, because Russia and China have already a big presence on Venezuela. In fact, China is buying more oil from Venezuela. Well, in terms of agreements, no, because Venezuela is sending oil for... Yep. For loan agreements. But China is receiving more oil than the U.S. from Venezuela. So there is a really important presence in Venezuela from China and Russia. And if U.S. pull back, that will just trigger more presence from other players around the world.
Sounds like limited leverage maybe on the oil front. Juan in Austin, Texas. Juan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I just wanted to briefly mention that the status quo is definitely not an option in the country, in the sense that the economic situation has deteriorated to the point where, for example, the GDP in the country has declined 35% for the last 4 years alone.
Yeah.
And
incredible.
Not only that, but inflation is running higher than 700% so far this year.
Mm-hmm.
The exchange rate has increased from 1,000 bolivars per dollar in August of 2016 to 12,000 bolivars per dollar.
Wow.
Now. So
yep.
People are really struggling down there, to the point where, again, I have family in Venezuela and I have other people that I know here in the U.S. that are actually sending food to Venezuelans on a monthly basis, just basic goods to survive, because
wow.
It's impossible to get by in Venezuela. So I think that's something that we need to keep in mind as well.
Absolutely.
That people are literally dying of hunger down there.
Sending food, people losing weight, the average weight going down. Jennifer, I mean, it's crisis mode right now, but what is the path toward getting Venezuela, you know, not just Maduro out, but also addressing the big economic picture? Many would not want to go back to the status quo before Chavez. Exactly. There were many, many there who were left out of the economy and really in poverty. Where's the path toward peace and prosperity here? Is that too much to dream of?
It's not. It looks very dark right now. But with increasing international pressure and isolation, in addition, although, and I would agree, it would be a bad idea to have an embargo on Venezuelan oil, because that would hurt the population. And Venezuela would look to India as another place they could sell to. They have to sell where people can actually refine the heavy crude they have.
Mm-hmm.
But increasing diplomatic isolation, refusal to recognize the authority of this new constituent assembly, which will probably be making financial transaction approvals, debt approvals, taking out loans. If the international community refuses to recognize those, that will also shrink the space for the government. But also, we need incentives. And to move forward and to encourage both sides to consider the possibility of a future together in this country, they need to have reassurances that neither side will be completely eliminated, because there are different points of view and different sectors of the population that need to be recognized and supported. So incentives from the international community for international emergency aid, but also reassurances from that there will be due process, that if a new government comes in, there will not be a witch hunt, recrimination. So that kind of thing.
Who's got the strength to guarantee all that, or even, you know, vaguely promise it?
Well, here I think international promises to serve as guarantors, monitoring compliance will be absolutely critical. I think what we should be aiming toward is a negotiated transitional government, because right now it's urgent to stabilize the economy. The deeper the hole they dig, the longer it's going to take to get out of this economic crisis, but also to restore the separation of powers, because right now, if we had elections, they would not be credible under this current electoral authority.
Moises, we've just got half a minute. Do you see a path toward negotiated transitional government at all?
Well, yes. If the international community keeps pressuring Maduro, if President Trump formally announced that they're not going to recognize this illegitimate constituent assembly, if other measures from other countries in the region but around the world also are implemented to increase that pressure, I think we're going to see a path forward for a negotiated transition government.
Crisis mode in Venezuela, and we're very grateful to the two of you for helping us look into it. Moises Rendon at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Thank you very much for being with us, Moises.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for the invitation.
And Jennifer McCoy in Atlanta at Georgia State University, thank you so much for your insights today.
Thank you as well, Tom.
In a moment, we will look at whether Congress will repair the Affordable Care Act or the president will move to let it fail. This is On Point. Senate Republicans have signaled they may not be on board with letting Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, fail, as President Trump has suggested, encouraged. There's a lot on the line here. So what's it going to be? Push it off a cliff or fix it? Joining me now from Washington is Noam Levy, national health care reporter at the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau. He's looking at the Senate's next moves to tackle health care. You can link to his latest article at our website, onpointradio.org. Noam, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So here was President Trump on Friday saying the Senate should let Obamacare fail. This was a speech in Long Island.
You know, I said from the beginning, let Obamacare implode and then do it. I turned out to be right. Let Obamacare implode.
Let Obamacare implode, and maybe more than that, maybe give it a nudge. Noam, the president has talked about taking steps that would or maybe push it over the edge. Is he still talking about that?
Well, we haven't had any angry tweets about it in the last few hours, so I don't know if I can answer that question directly. But he has continued to threaten to take steps that would essentially sabotage insurance markets around the country.
What would those be? What does he have the power to do that could and would it send the Affordable Care Act down the tubes?
So it's important to remember that what we're talking about here is only a part of the Affordable Care Act. We're not talking about the whole law. We're not talking about most of the people who've gotten coverage through through Obamacare. We're talking about that subset of Americans who purchase health insurance on their own, either directly through one of these Obamacare marketplaces like healthcare.gov or directly from an insurance company. So they're about 18 to 20 million people in that group around the country. Now, to keep these marketplaces stable, and it should be noted that they, for decades, this has been a relatively unstable market.
Mm-hmm.
To keep these marketplaces stable, the federal government does a number of things. One is enforce this penalty that forces that penalizes people for not having insurance. Another is providing federal aid to low-income Americans to help them with their copays and deductibles. The Trump administration has been threatening most immediately to do, and what is causing the most anxiety among insurers and among lawmakers from both parties, is this threat to withhold this aid that helps insurance companies cover the costs of copays and deductibles for low-income consumers.
And if they did that, you could say, I mean, you've already got companies pulling out in some markets. You'd see more of that? Just insurance wouldn't
almost
be
able to? Certainly, and health insurers around the country have very explicitly said without that assistance, they are going to be forced to raise their rates by as much as 20%, or they are exiting markets because of the uncertainty caused by the Trump administration.
So if you can't repeal it, maybe let it go over a cliff of a sort, in part at least, or help push it over. There's another impulse at work here, and we heard just yesterday, this is Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican, chairman of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee in the U.S. Senate, saying that the Senate would hold hearings the first week in September on how to not push it over a cliff, but how to stabilize the health insurance market. Here was Senator Alexander.
The reason for these hearings is that unless Congress acts by September 27, when insurance companies must sign contracts with the federal government to sell insurance on the federal exchange next year, millions of Americans with government subsidies in up to half our states may find themselves with zero options for buying health insurance on the exchanges in 2018.
That was Republican Senator Lamar Alexander, and of course his the senior Democrat on that committee, Senator Patty Murray, kind of alongside him in this. Noam Levy, is this bipartisan work to repair Obamacare breaking out?
I mean, I think it's the first glimmer of that. There are miles to go on this road for sure, but I think it's an important indication that there are a number of Republican lawmakers on Capitol Hill who may not love Obamacare, but believe that they have a responsibility for a variety of reasons to take steps to stabilize the markets and, quite frankly, to protect them from President Trump.
Could the White House and Senate Republicans part ways on this? Let's say the president, and he said he'll decide this week, but if he decides to pull the plug on some of this federal money that's kept the markets going, could he be stymied in that by Congress?
Well, in a word, yes, although it would be very messy. Because if Congress appropriates this money, this assistance, it would take presumably some time to do that. And then it would require, if it's on a piece of legislation, it would require President Trump's signature. While that's happening, President Trump could decide to withhold this aid, which would, as we talked about, cause a fair amount of chaos in the market. It would cause insurance premiums to jump. And it should be noted that it's actually not the lowest income people who would probably be affected by this, because they get other assistance. It's people who don't have federal assistance, people who are middle class or above who buy insurance, who don't have any protections from big rate hikes. Those are the folks who are sort of in the firing line right here. If Trump decides that he doesn't want to fund this for whatever reason next month or in October, or in September, you may have insurers making decisions that they have to raise rates because we are, as Senator Alexander indicated in the clip you played, coming up against the deadline when they have to decide if they're going to participate in these marketplaces and what rates they're going to charge.
And what about Mitch McConnell? Is he all finished with this? You report that you've got Republican Senators Orrin Hatch, Roy Blunt, John Thune, maybe in a coordinated signaling that it's time to just move on past this. Or could McConnell still put the repeal and replace effort back on the table?
He could certainly put it back on the table, and there are a number of Republican lawmakers who are still interested in a big repeal bill, both in the House and the Senate, and they're working on it quietly at the moment. But I think some of those comments from Leader McConnell and other senior Republicans do reflect a certain amount of weariness with the campaign. Recall that the process last week was pretty ugly, and the American public has soured pretty dramatically on the repeal push. Less than 20% approved of what Senate Republicans were trying to do. So there is a feeling that it wouldn't be such a bad thing to move on if you're a Republican. And clearly, Republicans have other priorities, such as tax reform, that they want to get to. And the longer that they keep fighting about health care, the less time they have to address those other issues.
If they don't bring it back, then are they more or less forced to get in there and work with Democrats to fix this unless they go down the Trump route and let it fail?
Yes, they are. I think part of that reflects, again, the fact that if you are like Senator Alexander from Tennessee, if you come from a state in which there are thousands and thousands of your constituents who depend on health insurance that they purchase on their own, if they don't have choices, if their premiums start going through the roof, those are constituents who are going to be, A, complaining to you, and B, the polling is really clear on this. Notwithstanding what President Trump has tried to say, the American public believes that President Trump and congressional Republicans have responsibility for the healthcare system now. If it tanks, they're going to pay the price.
How strange is it going to feel after all of this to have sort of old-fashioned bipartisan hearings in early September on this, Noah?
We haven't been there in a long time.
Wow. Healthcare on some kind of wild road here in this country. Noam Levy following it all for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, thanks very much for being with us today.
Always good to be with you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. You can follow me on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. And there you are, from Venezuela, from Caracas, to the heart of the healthcare debate in Washington right now. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Thank you.